Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. In the 1998 film The Truman Show, Jim Carrey plays a man who becomes aware that his entire life has been the subject of a reality TV show broadcast 24/7 to people around the world.
Why don't you let me fix you some of this new Mo Cocoa drink? All natural cocoa beans from the upper slopes of Mount Nicaragua, no artificial sweeteners.
What the hell are you talking about? Who are you talking to? Tell me what's happening!
Well, you're having a nervous breakdown. That's what's happening.
You're part of this, aren't you?
A few years after the film, psychiatrist Joel Gold began to notice an increasing number of patients convinced that their lives were being similarly filmed and broadcast. He called it the Truman Show delusion and began to explore its particular character with his brother Ian, a neurophilosopher at McGill University. At a time when mental illness is increasingly viewed through the lens of neuroscience and genetics and treated with pharmaceuticals, the Gold brothers explore connections between the development of psychosis and schizophrenia and changes in culture and social life, from bullying to immigration to urban living. It's a new approach to considering the interaction between the brain and the world around us, and it's covered in a book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. Virginia spoke to Joel when the book was first published. It's now available in paperback.
Joel Gold, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now tell us about that very first patient, Albert. This was back in October of 2003. You describe him as your first Truman Show patient.
Yeah, it was Halloween. I remember pretty clearly a Friday. He was admitted to my unit, and he described his life just as you described it. His life was a reality show. In fact, he mentioned the Truman Show. He said, "My life is like the Truman Show." At the time, I didn't make too much of it. It was fascinating. He had come to New York from out of state. His idea was that if he had come and found that the Twin Towers were still standing, he would know that even the attacks of 9/11 were essentially a put-on for him just to get a reaction for the show. But if they were in fact destroyed, he would acknowledge that perhaps he was delusional, which is actually somewhat unusual for people to have that insight that they might be ill. When he came to New York, unfortunately for him, he didn't get to the World Trade Center. He got as far as the United Nations, and at that point he decided to seek asylum from the show by going to the UN. A scuffle ensued, and he was brought to Bellevue. Again, I didn't make too much of it, as we see so many fascinating delusions at Bellevue. But over the course of time, I saw more and more of these patients and started connecting the dots.
More and more people saying, you know, my father is an actor paid to play my father. The people around me are actors. But is this delusion just a new name for an old delusion? Would it have been called something different in the 1950s or 60s?
Absolutely. We looked into this over the course of the writing of the book, and initially we weren't really sure if this was something new or something that had existed. There's a form and content question, and we discovered that over the course of time, there were only a handful, maybe a dozen forms of delusion: paranoid or persecutory, grandiose, religious, etc. And many people believed, and we came to believe, that over the course of time, as culture changes, so too do the delusions, the content changes. So in the backdrop of the Cold War, for instance, people might have thought that the KGB were after them, or that the CIA had implanted a microchip in their tooth. As we now live in a society of reality television and surveillance, that has now come to fill in the blanks, so to speak, of these kinds of delusions. And initially, we had the thought that it was more of a persecutory and grandiose delusion. As time passed, we came to think of it as more of a delusion of control, wherein people feel like they're not really in control of their own lives.
Now, we see these kind of cycles of belief, of where madness is coming from. Is it spirit? Is it the brain structure? Is it environmental factors? How does this history and those cycles inform your theory?
That's a wonderful question, and absolutely, over the course of time, things have changed. We often think of psychiatry as having started with Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, and then the advent of psychotropic medications in the 60s, 70s, and beyond. But in fact, before that, in ancient times and really up until Freud, it was very much like it is today, very much a biological approach. Something is wrong with the brain. And people would, you know, bore holes in skulls and, you know, the kind of bleeding with leeches approach, that there was something wrong with the humors. Now we've returned clearly with a vengeance to the biological model. And I'm not at all opposed. I worked at Bellevue and I was very comfortable prescribing antipsychotic medication to my patients who were suffering from delusions and hallucinations. But I believe that the pendulum has swung too far in the direction of the biological, both in terms of the cause of psychosis and the treatment. So I think that it's very important not just to look at the biological underpinnings, but the environmental contributors to one developing psychosis, schizophrenia, for instance, and that you can actually do talk therapy of a kind with psychotic individuals and get results. And it's not simply reaching for the prescription pad.
So let's get into that theory. Your theory is that we need to look beyond neurology or genetics to consider psychosis and schizophrenia to cultural or cognitive factors. And this leads to your research into evolutionary psychology, and you come up with this hypothesis about the suspicion system that gives the book its title. So what is the suspicion system? What is its function?
Well, we believe that there's a part of the brain, and we have no particular sense of what the anatomy is, though we might guess at it. But this function is something that evolutionarily has developed in order to act as a kind of an alarm that will detect danger in the environment, particularly social danger. But when that system goes awry, instead of being able to question those initial thoughts, like someone's walking in the forest, if you hear that crack, you quickly turn around. Mm-hmm. Is it an animal that's chasing after me? And you think, no, it's just the wind. That's what we call the reflective system, the slower ability to reflect on that initial impulse. But if that initial impulse doesn't shut down, it becomes hypertrophy to the point where it really is now a delusion that's very firmly held.
So the system that we as human beings have to fear, the Bengal tiger, I guess, in the woods,
right,
suddenly factors in our whole place inside of a social structure.
Yeah. In times long ago, people lived in, you know, villages, small towns, and there's some research that suggests that our brain is only able to really fit about 125 or 150 people in there. And what I mean by that is, if you live in a small town with about 100, 150 people, you pretty much know most of the people in it, if not all of them. And so you can feel a little bit more comfortable. But as cities grow in number, there are more unknown others. And when there are unknown others, there's a sense that they may mean to do us harm. And so this system becomes more important in a sense. And there is evidence that the larger the city one lives in, the greater the incidence of psychosis and schizophrenia. It's actually well established, much like living in a large city might put one at higher risk for lung cancer because the air is not as clean. People don't really know about this, including psychiatrists and psychiatric researchers, that certain environmental factors such as living in an urban environment, being an immigrant, or being a survivor of child abuse makes one higher risk for developing psychosis later in life. And these are, again, environmental factors, much like smoking cigarettes is for lung cancer and heart disease.
What is the role of culture in influencing delusions, psychoses, or schizophrenia? Joel Gold and his brother Ian have been researching that very topic and the incidence of something they call the Truman Show delusion. It's covered in a new book called Suspicious Minds: How Culture Shapes Madness. You're looking at delusions as a malfunctioning response to a social environment, right?
Absolutely.
What is the relationship to that and the Truman Show delusion? What purpose does that serve?
If things feel not quite right, one has to be on their guard. Again, like the Bengal tiger you referenced, if there are all of these people and they seem a bit strange, I don't know, they're looking at me, they're making signs, maybe there's something going on here. And then perhaps you see or remember the movie, it inflames the suspicion system, so to speak. And instead of, oh, I don't know, maybe I'm just having a strange day, I didn't get a good night's sleep, if someone has, again, these risk factors, suddenly they may be using the Truman Show effect to act as a kind of scaffolding for their feelings. But if we become so much on guard that we're not able to step out of it, we have these persecutory ideas. And then for, again, a number of these younger people, late teens, early 20s, who may be inching into psychosis, the Truman Show might resonate with them in a sense, and they say, yes, this is my life. And it's very hard to move them out of that.
Joel, very early in the book, you say that you are seeking some balance in the conversation about the role that genetics and neurobiology play as compared to experience, culture, society, environment. But I know in my life and probably the lives of many others, there are people close to us with mental illness, and in many ways, acknowledging the role of biology and genetics destigmatizes, depersonalizes, takes away this sense of fault or shame. So what's the balance in that conversation?
Oh, I think that's such an important point. For many years, particularly during the height of psychoanalytic theory, there was the notion of the schizophrenogenic mother, the cold, uncaring, aggressive mother who would actually induce schizophrenia in their child. And for many years, this was obviously not true and very, very painful for families who were either enraged because they knew it wasn't the case, that they were loving parents, loving siblings, or intense guilt. What did I do? Maybe I should have done this or that and my child would be well. So in that regard, the biologization of psychosis and schizophrenia was a wonderful thing for those patients and their families. At the same time, it would be irresponsible of us to recognize that there are environmental factors. Most families of schizophrenic patients have loving, wonderful families, but that's not to say that there aren't, unfortunately, some kids who are severely abused, and those kids who are abused are at higher risk. So we're not painting everyone with a broad brush, but that's just the fact. But we want to make it clear we're not suggesting that because we want to look at the environment and culture that we're pointing fingers at family members. If someone lives in an urban environment and therefore, you know, including myself, you're in New Hampshire, I'm in New York, and in that sense, I'm at higher risk for developing schizophrenia than you are, one could say, well, am I being unfair to my kids by choosing to live in a large city? Perhaps I should move to, you know, a bucolic town and lower their risk. But most of us don't do that. And so we have to live in the world in which we do. And I think this is something that very, very challenging for families and for patients.
Joel Gold, thank you so much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Gold and his brother Ian have together written a book called Suspicious Minds, How Culture Shapes Madness. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. We're caught in a trap.